Welcome to pod 59 of the official Palace pod. I'm Chris Grierson from Palace TV, which you can Google to find out where to watch it. It's everywhere. It's on all the Palace things. Because last time I mentioned that I should really pre-record it. So this time I thought I'd just do something completely different just to mix it up. This is a really, really long podcast. It was an incredible chat that I just listened to, really. I was supposed to be doing an interview. I had loads of questions, did loads of prep, but it turns out Gary O'Reilly is a very talented media man. So he led the conversation. So it was a conversation between Gary O'Reilly, who's a central defender that played for Palace, I'm sure you all know, and Nigel Martin, legendary Palace goalkeeper, who played for the club from 1989 to 1996. He was the first £1 million goalkeeper. He was talking from somewhere, he said he's somewhere between Harrogate and Leeds, and Gary O'Reilly was talking from Long Island in New York, and it was really interesting to hear them chat. There is one bit where I play clips from the 1990 final and they talk over the top of them, which obviously looks a lot better. Well, it works better when you're looking at the clips, so it's not necessarily for podcast, but we're going to chuck it in anyway because they say some great stuff over the top of it. So here is our epic chat between Gary O'Reilly and Nigel Martin, which was done, as I mentioned in it, in association with the FA and the Heads Up campaign and Down Memory Lane. Hello and welcome to this extra special lockdown Down Memory Lane event. I'm at home, obviously. Memory Lane normally happens at Sellers Park Stadium. It's held in association with the Heads Up campaign. Heads Together and the FA have teamed up to run a season-long campaign to change the conversation around mental health. This time, it's all about the 1990 team. You may have been to Sellers already and seen Terry Byfield in action on the stage and got your questions to the players. Well, today, I am going to be talking to Nigel Martin and Gary O'Reilly about that amazing 1990 FA Cup final, because it is the 30-year anniversary of that game. Let's speak to the guys now. Not a bad...
Gary, how are you?
Hey, how are we?
Oh, I'm not
very good.
We've got a gallery view.
Ah, what are you doing back there? Coffee.
Yes, I've done the same.
Yeah, can't find a big enough mug.
Let's start off with Gary. Obviously,
oh, gosh.
At the moment, before lockdown, you're out in the city. Yeah. What are you doing? Yes.
Right now, I work like I did back in the UK in media. I co-host a podcast. I produce the podcast. It's a science sports show rather than a sports science show. So I get a rather famous scientist that if I tell you his name, you probably will never have heard of. He's that famous. No, his name is Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's very popular, very famous, and a particularly smart guy. So we have the pleasure to work with him. So that's a lot of fun. We get to work with former NFL players, basketball stars, boxers, cyclists, every sport, and with the science that's in it. And we have some fun, a lot of fun. It's part of a show called Star Talk. And that was a TV show that was nominated for 4 Emmys. So that's the sort of blueprint that's in there. Along with that, there's a national radio station here, Sirius XM. So I host and co-host shows on that, which is, again, a lot of fun. It's all about football, or if you prefer, soccer. It's a lot of good things. So just developing one or two things at the moment over here.
You were always interested in that when you were playing, weren't you, Gary? I remember, you know, being called Stretch and everything. You know, you were really trying to get, you were trying to prolong your career and stay as fit as you possibly could. I noticed that sort of towards, you know, when I first got to the club.
That was something I sort of got exposed to, surprisingly enough, after an injury. And it's that sort of thought stayed with me, and how you can develop, how you work, how you use the science, how you use technology. You know, just look at our game. You know, from when we started and when we finished, the movement forward in terms of the understanding of medical science, the understanding of data, the understanding of analytics, the use of specialized training for strength and conditioning, Now it's almost limitless as to what we do and introduce into the development of our game, all in the pursuit of putting the ball in the back of the net.
Yeah, and keeping people fitter and stronger for longer.
Absolutely. It's things that would finish a career are just bumps in the road that you can get over now, which is great. I mean, the science is there for medicine. The understanding of how we get the best out of our bodies is there. I mean, it's just, and what some athletes are doing now is just incredible.
You played pretty late to a pretty old, fairly old age for a footballer, Nigel, didn't you? Were you around 40 when you retired?
Yeah, just short of 40 when...
Good for you.
When the ankle gave in, I got a stress fracture in my talus, which I was playing with pain, but I didn't realise quite the extent of what I'd done. So I played about 3 months. It was my last season at Everton. We were in a bit of a relegation battle. So it was a case of going out there and just trying to play if I could, and sort of managed 3 months with it progressively getting worse and worse. And then I remember we beat Arsenal at home 1-0, and we beat Sunderland away 1-0, and we got to about 33 points. And it was just it was coming January time, and David Moyes said, right, I think we've got enough points. We'll play you this week in the cup. We've got Chelsea in the cup, who were the Premier League champions at the time. And then we'll get your ankle sorted. So I played that game, had a decent game. We drew 1-1, and then went away and eventually found through a CT scan that I've got a stress fracture, and it will never heal. So that stress fracture is a permanent one. So that would be something that would finish you. But, luckily, I guess, enough. I got it when I was 39 coming up to 40 and not 19 coming up to 20. So you have to take it when it comes.
It's a fair career, though, Nigel.
Yeah, I was lucky. Yeah,
I think you may have had a bit to play in that. You can't have a career that long and be lucky. I think there's an awful lot of talent in there, which we found out very early on your arrival at the club. It was like, all right. I mean, Perry Suckling was a great goalkeeper, but
yeah,
that needs to be said. But you just raised the bar. And I think that a lot of Palace fans will have seen that at the time.
It was quite surreal getting into football, playing in Cornwall, no scouting as such. It literally is what, the story is what you've probably heard. A guy owned a carpet shop in a little town in Cornwall called St. Blasey that I was playing football for. He used to wander along and watch. He knew the tea lady at Bristol Rovers. He rang her and said, we've got a really good goalie. She walked into Jerry Francis's office and told him. And he said, well, why don't you get him up? So I literally went and stayed with that tea lady for, Thursday and the Friday. And I played half a game against Gillingham on the Saturday. And he signed me straight after. It was such a bizarre way. It couldn't happen.
Thank heaven for tea ladies.
Absolutely. And then 2 and a bit years later, I get a move to Palace, and it was all really, really fast. It's probably when you finish and look back, you think, God, I wouldn't want to do that again now. But when you're younger, you just go with it, don't you?
Oh, of course you do. But I'll be honest with you, you arriving at Palace at that particular time in history, from sweet, lovely southwest of the UK, I think culture shock possibly is the only way I can phrase it. Particularly when you think we had Righty, Brighty, Andy Gray, and that's enough to be going on with. throw in there Andy Thorne, and it's just, and Parts, and of course,
Jeff, and yeah, I know.
It was just a very interesting environment to walk into.
It was. I mean, I'd literally got married from signing my first ever contract at Bristol Rovers, and then I played my debut on the Saturday and then got married the following Monday down in Cornwall, and then travelled up. So me and Amanda were we were just married when I moved to Bristol Rovers, if you like, and then moving to London. Amanda's, one of the first things we did, we were put up in the Selsdon Park Hotel.
Nice.
I went to training one day. Amanda got a taxi into Croydon and got lost in Alders.
That'll do. That'll happen.
Yeah, and yeah. Couldn't find a way out, and then eventually got a way out, got a taxi, came home, and she was really, she was quite upset because she said, imagine. "I don't know if I could do this. It's massive. The place is huge, you know."
And it Orders was a real... is a big store. Orders is a giant store.
I know. Yeah, I know. When you the giant store, you know, down in Cornwall is nowhere near as big as that.
No, it's true.
So it was a culture shock for both of us because it was an eye-opener for me because the lads at Bristol Rovers were great, but, you know, they were down to earth because they were lower league players, and suddenly you've come in to a change room with lots of sort of big egos and funny guys, you know, all sort of vying for centre spot all the time. It was it was quite good fun, but I just, you know, I was quite shy anyway, so I just sort of kept my mouth shut for most of the time and just.
I think what we learned was you had the sense to stay out of it.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I just, you know, you move to a new club, and I think you've got to earn your right in the pecking order first before you do anything. It's not. I don't think you can go straight in and try and be.
You couldn't walk into a dressing room like we had then. And then stamp your foot and say, this place is mine. Not with the people we had in there.
No.
You'd be lighting yourself up and sticking yourself in the crosshairs if you started to engage. And if you didn't have the wherewithal to do it, you would have a terrible time. Because I won't mention names because it's not fair, but there were some players that did that and they found it very, very difficult.
Yeah, I got shot
very down. Difficult. Times. Yeah, they did. But I'm just thinking back, and it's, I mean, I saw something on a message, on a tweet, a little while ago, and it's 30 years ago.
Mm.
And then I looked at it, because I'm smart like this. That's basically half my life away, right? I'm pushing 60, I'll be 60 next year, and I'm thinking 30 years ago, wow. Some of the memories are fresh, some of them are like, oh, wow, that happened. Yeah, I remember that, kind of. But it's what struck me the most was how, and I don't know if you feel the same, Nigel, how it sat in people's memories, the effect, not just on Palace fans from the semi-final and the final, but the impact it's had on the greater football family, the people who are saying, oh, I remember that, dot, dot, dot. And it's still to this day, and back in the back in the UK, where the BBC put on that Super Sunday,
yeah.
And you think back, we were test driving what Sky Sports did for decades on the Super Sunday, the back to back, the big stuff, I think everybody just went, wow, this could be incredible. Because we served up two of the best games they've seen in FA Cup history for some time. So, yeah, it's funny how this game, the semi-final, and then the final itself has such a legacy in the football landscape, even though we decided not to win, which was big of us, I thought.
Yeah.
And although if Wrighty were on this call, he would tell you it's my fault and Nigel's fault and not his. But that's Wrighty. So that's the way it goes.
Yeah. Well, you know, we can't defend. We did let in three goals and he did score two the first game.
No, I have a theory that Steve Coppell only sent him on because he was so fed up with him in his ear. in the dugout on the sideline. So I've had enough. Get him on. Just get him out of my sight. Get him on the pitch. I don't need him in my ear anymore. But then again, at that moment, the best thing you could probably do for Ian was to make him sub, because he would just ratchet up everything.
Yeah.
And then you just release him.
Yeah. I spoke to Gary Pallister actually not long after in an England squad. And he said after the first game, he was petrified that we were going to play Wrighty from the start. Absolutely petrified, because he got turned inside out, didn't he? And he said he hated playing against Wrighty always. And he said when they saw the team sheet and he wasn't starting, he said, I was so happy.
Yeah, I mean, as a defender, Wrighty would twist your blood.
Yeah.
He had that capability. And a bit like when, you'll remember this, although were you at the club? I think you may have been. We were up at Old Trafford that season and we beat Manchester United at Old Trafford.
2-1.
Yes. And Sir Alex, bless him, I looked at the team sheet and went, Mark Hughes is on the bench. Fabulous.
Yeah.
And strikers, when they're of that calibre, for defenders, are great when you see them on the bench. I've probably got at least 45 minutes of him being there rather than him being here giving me a torrid time.
Yeah.
So I can see why Pally would be very happy to see him on the bench.
Yeah, obviously. I mean, I don't know how many weeks earlier he broke his leg, but it
was... 6 weeks, was it?
5 or 6 weeks. It was close, wasn't it? And obviously, you know, he wasn't ready for the semi. But then, you know, he did so well in the first final, if you like. And then, you know, was it, could he have done an hour?
Yeah.
You know.
What do you do? Put him in to begin with or put him in some part as the game progresses? It's a difficult one. I think, I mean, the person we haven't mentioned and the person that rarely gets mentioned is the physio, David West.
Yeah.
Who was responsible because Ian broke his leg twice that season.
Yeah.
And each time David brings him back. And obviously in having the career that Ian had, you have to say David didn't do a bad job getting him into the right place. And I think they discussed how, because I mean, it's like having the Ferrari in the garage and cycling everywhere. You know, sooner or later, you're going to scratch that itch and you're going to bring Ian into the game. It's whether or not you start. And that's, I think, they took a decision, and it can't have been an easy decision for Steve and with Alan Smith and the think tank that we had to decide to go with Ian on the bench to begin with in the second game. It's that invisible part of management that we and you and I now, Nigel, like, we understand a bit better.
Yes. Yeah.
When you're in the heat of it and 20 something, it's like, well, why didn't he do that?
Well, we're all great in retrospect, don't we? When we, you know,
hindsight is perfect, as they say.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, potentially he could have done the same thing. I think where they were smart, they got, you know, they changed their goalkeeper, didn't they?
Yeah. I mean, looking...
And Leslie's that type of guy that's going to really get them all going.
Les, God rest his soul, Les Seeley, would come off his line, would be positive. He, as a goalkeeper, you'll know this. All right, I'll make that decision. Everyone else around me can react to my decision. If I don't make a decision, everyone else is going, well, are you or aren't you? Will he, won't he? And that's when the problems start. As you, your career, you played in front, you played behind some great players. So he probably didn't have too many of those problems.
No, I did. I mean, coming for crosses was never a strongest point of mine. It's something that probably got better as I got older. You know, when you're very young, you decide you want to come for every cross, and then you sort of quickly learn that that's not the right thing to do. And then you go through a spell where you perhaps don't come for as many as you should. And then you sort of settle down and you start realizing what balls are yours and what balls to leave alone and let your centre halves to deal with.
So we didn't have a goalkeeping coach, did we?
Peter Benetti was there when I came.
Yes.
But Peter left at the end of that season.
Yeah.
So
Now you mentioned it, I had forgotten completely that Peter was there. Another one, God rest his soul. What a lovely man. What a lovely man. But we didn't have those dedicated goalkeeper coaches in clubs really at that time. There were a couple of guys would float between. So Peter would do Chelsea, he'd do Palace, he'd do something else in that London area. But things have moved on. Definitely moved on. I mean,
for the better as well, you know, goalkeeping wise, you know, at Palace, I mean, I had Peter when I started and then sort of nobody. And then Steve Harrison started doing a bit of goalkeeping training after training when he was there at the club. Yeah. And then Big Vic Bettinelli, who became the kit man or was the kit man. He was a goalie. So he sort of took it over. So it was literally after training. You know, so you'd finished everything and then you'd go out maybe, well, you'd have lunch and then I'd be doing extra sessions of goalkeeping. So to, you know, once my career started going more, further on, once you've got that goalkeeper coach, yes, we'd start probably half an hour, 40 minutes before everyone else, but it was good to get the work done at the same time as everybody else.
And then it just makes a lot of sense. I mean, I was always banging on about we should be specialised position, goalkeeper. Mm-hmm. You need specialised work. You talked about crossing. I need you to understand angles.
Yeah.
And you don't have to be a mathematician. It's a case of I need you through experience and I need to set you up in situations where you see for yourself how this will work better for you, for everybody. The work we used to do as a back unit, you, the back four, or maybe a midfield or two midfield players, mm-hmm. that work had to happen. And we did that and we were very good at that. But then I always thought, well, we need to work on a left side. So it would be Sulaco. It might be whoever the fullback was at that moment, because we sort of flipped in and out of left backs for a while. Whoever that was, we worked as a unit down there with interlinking with a centre midfield player and the same on the right. We would work with the strikers, but we would never work with certain individual units of midfield or right side or left side. But that all developed. All developed very, very quickly. And I think the influx of foreign coaches helped immensely in the tactical side of things.
It did. I mean, when I moved to Leeds, obviously Howard Wilkinson bought me, but within about 6 weeks, he got the sack and George Graham came. And George spent a lot of time doing that. Personally, it was great for me because I could understand why Dave Seaman got so many clean sheets, because literally the back four were drilled. With the midfield, he would start with two in the middle and then he would put it as two banks of four. And it was just, we were just so difficult to break down. He got me back in the England squad, actually, because I wasn't playing any different. I was just keeping clean sheets because I had less to do.
I mean, it's the same thing, but from a different point of view. And I think we've, you know, as your career progressed, that point of view changed as coaches developed and understood the influx of foreign coaches, the fact that coaches now from the English football would leave and go abroad, study and come back.
Yeah.
And they'd bring that thinking with them. I mean, how many South American players did you play with? Did you play with many or any?
Crumbs. I'm trying to think. I don't think so. I don't think there were any.
Because they were playing a game of football that we knew nothing about. And that thinking would come in. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden you'd see how they saw what we thought we were doing brilliantly. Because, you know, we invented the game, or we were in there winning European Cups, or we were doing this and doing that. And then you saw how things could potentially move forward. I mean, looking back to the way we played at Palace, I would say efficient, direct, but with more intelligence than people gave us credit for. You know, we knew that we had to put Ian and Mark in a situation where they had more opportunities to score. We then at the other end had to think about how we made you work less.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, the provision of opportunity, the denial of opportunity at the other end. And I think that became something that we did particularly well.
Yeah, we did. I think at times, looking back, we were quite gung-ho going forward and very open. You know, if you played against the Man City now, they would love a team to try and come onto them like that because they would just pick you off. You know, you couldn't push as many players forward as perhaps we did at the time, because we, you know, if the ball got in the box, there was invariably sort of at least four in there looking for the goal.
We see, this is what you've described there is us being beaten 9-0 at Anfield.
Right.
And people said to us, what was it like? I said, well, let me put it to you this way. We didn't have reverse in the gearbox. We just went that way. And off we go. And Liverpool went, oh, please. They just racked up a cricket score on us. And that was the point. I mean, you look back at the season and I think there was a collective point where it couldn't get any lower. So therefore, we had to go up. And then the other thing, and this is what I, looking back with that perfect hindsight, we were such a young group. I mean, apart from me.
You were really old, 30.
I was look, 29 and over the hill. It was so easy for them to bounce back because, I mean, Sulaco and Shaw were 19 years of age.
Yeah.
Well, whatever. Just get back on the saddle and go again. You know, we had young players. We had players that, you know, Mark and Ian just wanted to score goals. And they just wanted someone to provide them with the opportunity to score goals. So that was their drive. And you had then the character of people like Jeff, the character of people like yourself, like Alan Pardew, and people around the team who just went, no. We're coming back. And that, you know, you look back in it and I look at teams that have been successful, have achieved things, and they have a similar attitude. And I'd like, if you agree or not, but there's that percentage of winners, that winning mentality, guys who will give everything to win.
Yeah.
And I thought we had a higher percentage of that. May not have been the most talented.
No.
But there was definitely a desire to want to win that drove this team at this particular time forward.
Yeah, well, I think that's something that should be common in everyone, you know, that I hate losing, no matter what the game, the sport, whatever. It's, you know, you have that from a long time. And when you get into a club, a team, you just want to give everything you've got to win a game with your mates. And it doesn't matter at what level that is. That sort of feeling, I think, sort of stays the same, you know.
And it should be. And I think anyone assembling a team, here we are, Nigel and I will tell you how to do it. Here we go, pin back your ears. So it's that situation where you say, and I think Steve saw this. I think if you roll it back a few years, when Steve started to assemble the beginning of this team, you look at players who wanted to prove something, players that were hungry, players that had a desire to reappear on the radar, to win. And he recruited and brought those in. You know, even guys like Dave Madden.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who was I want to call bit part player, but that's rude and it's disrespectful. But he didn't play as many games because of Alan and Jeff's strength in midfield and with Andy, obviously.
Yeah.
But that character was there and it was there in so many different individuals around the team. You know, Jeff Hopkins.
Yeah.
People like that. There was, you know, great people that were assembled and you can see why they were brought into the club.
Yeah. And being a little bit older, they were also sort of showing us the ropes, really. The younger lads, when I first came, I was 23. Yeah. Like you mentioned, John and Richard as well. It's sort of, there was a discipline there, wasn't there, for the youngsters to follow. Mm. You know, if you want to be in this team, you this is the way we do it.
Absolutely. And there were lots of lessons that were being learned, you know, and I think Ian Branfoot, who was around the first team as a coach back then, worked one-to-one with John Sulaco and actually told John about his right foot, which was a surprise to John. And it was that situation where all of a sudden you saw John Sulaco develop within a very short space of time into an England international.
Yeah.
Because athletically, he had everything. It was understanding how he got the best out of his abilities. And that was always going to take a little while because he was still a teenager. But by the time he was 21, I mean, it was obvious. He'd seen all the other things. I mean, Richard Shaw was another one. You know, he was, I always thought Richard was an excellent player.
Yeah,
he was. You know, that opinion never changed. So, yeah, there was...
He went away to Hull, didn't he? He sort of went away as a young lad, played a few games in Hull's first team with Billy Whitehurst and the
like. That'll change you.
Yeah, and Richard came back after 3 months. He sort of went a boy and came back as a man, really. And suddenly you see that development that had happened and that's how he forced his way into the team.
No, the same. I mean, Chris Powell was around at the same time.
Yeah.
And Chris, you know, but there was a lot of good talent beneath the first team at the club. I mean, this is history that Palace fans know and don't need, you know, to be told. But, you know, from where we are in time looking back, you weren't quite sure whether that talent would develop and go the distance.
No, and you don't know how good it is at that time, do you?
No, you're never quite sure. And it was, I mean, yeah, it was substantial. Absolutely substantial amount of talent, you know, coming through. And, you know, if you think when we played in 1990, how many players were international players?
Yeah.
Had Eddie made a debut for the Republic of Ireland at that point?
I'm not sure.
He may have done.
I think he may have done, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Wrighty was on the fringes of being called up, had he not? But maybe not in 90.
1990, after the World Cup, me and Wrighty got a call up because we roomed together. And Wrighty, I was in the room as Wrighty put on his England training kit for the first time. And you know what he's like. He was just absolutely made up. He was just standing in front of the mirror and just sort of, I can't believe it. Look at this. Yeah, look at this. Three lines is everywhere. And he's like, he couldn't believe it.
That would have been a magic moment to watch. But for him, would have been a point on the journey that he thought about and dreamt about, but never quite felt that he could achieve it. So that would have been a special moment. So what I'm saying is, at that point in the 89-90 season, we didn't have any internationals.
No.
But you
Jeff
went.
Jeff may have been at playing for Wales. Perhaps the only one.
Yes, point taken. Yeah, Jeff had that, so we'll credit that one. So we had one. So you then end up with Eddie McGoldrick, Ian, Jeff Thomas, Andy Gray, John Sulaco, and yourself. You know, at the time, it wasn't fancied. It wasn't recognised, as you say. But then history, as you read turn the pages, proves that there's a reason why this particular vintage of Palace teams went where it went and achieved what it did, because the talent actually was there. It just hadn't quite been recognised. It hadn't quite fully developed.
No.
So, yeah.
No, you go from 1990. I came into a struggling First Division team.
Yep.
And the following year, we're challenging. And you could see the way the lads were playing was completely different from, you know, you come into a team that's struggling a little bit. The cup run was a great bonus for us. But in the league, we were really struggling. You could see that the effort and the application was there. We just weren't getting the results. And then you stay up. And then pre-season happens. And you go into the next season and have such a good start. And then it was just completely different. The way the lads played with freedom and energy and strength, it was great to be able to watch from behind. And, you know,
it was, the difference was belief. I think getting promoted the season before and having that first time around and taking a few knocks, to put it nicely, your confidence levels aren't as high.
Yeah.
I think with it being a young team, and having that cup run, having survived, you know, and not by goal difference, but I think we were fifth from bottom, which was a triumph, really. If can't understate that. But the belief that we had on the back of that. Remember the pre-season after the cup final. So we had the cup final. Then it was Italia 90, which was one of the most spectacular World Cups. And then we went back to Italy for a pre-season.
Yeah.
We played Sampdoria and Fiorentina.
Yes.
And we didn't get beaten. We drew one and won one. We beat Sampdoria on penalties?
Yeah, I think so. I can remember I remember them taking a penalty for some reason, but I didn't know if that was in the game or whether...
Yeah. And so, you know, you talk about pre-season, it was a case of... Yeah. I mean, I remember Andy Gray playing in midfield, surprisingly enough, against, I think it was Sampdoria, and it was basically all of the names you'd heard of a month or so before in the World Cup, and he just showed them exactly how he thought things should go. And he was just ridiculous, just ridiculous. And when Andy's on that kind of form, he's special.
Yeah, I don't think he looks probably in our league, he would look against, you know, if he's playing against Brian Robson, oh, I'm playing against Brian Robson. But if, you know, internationally, he probably didn't even know who half these people were. I know they were household names from that. And yeah. he didn't care about, you know, people's reputations, did he? He just went out and did his thing and imposed himself.
Yeah, he just played. He wanted, that's how he saw the game and that's how he would do it. And, you know, Jeff was a different force altogether. Far more focused. And Jeff would try and be a positive influence for everybody around him.
Yeah.
And always try and get another 10% or so out of you. And that, you know, that leadership quality was definitely there.
Yeah, he was good, wasn't he? He looked after everybody, really, as the captain. He was here, there, and everywhere. He led by example. He really did.
Yeah.
You know, on the pitch, he you know, he never shirked a tackle. He, you know, he drove the team on always. But I remember sort of things happening where he was, you know, things happening at the club, and Jeff would be the one that would go in and sort everything out, and you know, 9 times out of 10 get it sorted for the lads every time. So
yeah, and there was always something going on at the club back then.
Yeah,
there was always something, and that was that. Yeah, it's strange, you know. In the moment, it was frustrating. It would drive you mad, but looking back on it, it's kind of like, oh yeah, that was interesting. And you don't feel as difficult, as bad as, although there were one or two things that needed addressing and were important, but they're things that we've moved on from.
Yeah, you're saying about Andy. Andy obviously forced his way into the England team.
Yes.
And I was actually sitting on the bench. I think it was the Czech Republic, something like that. Mm. And Graham Taylor gave Andy his debut. And We practiced this kickoff beforehand, and it was Mark Hateley was playing up front, and it was somebody passed it to Mark. Mark laid it back for Andy Gray, but a lot of care had to be emphasised on this pass. So Andy's job was to hit a diagonal out for a throw-in right in the final third of them. Mark Hateley had to sprint, cut the keeper off so he couldn't get the ball straight back in. And we would start the game in their final third and close them all in. Now, Andy had some sort of falling out with Graham Taylor. Something had happened. He was going to sign, or he didn't sign, or he left and he shouldn't have done, or something really, you know. So the ball got passed. Mark Hateley laid it back, and Andy Gray has pinged a great diagonal ball straight out. And Graham Taylor turned to us all on the bench and went, first touch in international football, look, and he's kicked it straight out for a throw-in. and that was a manager trying to get back at a player for something. I can see why, you know, he's got him back, but we have started on the front foot. So it was a double edged.
Andy could do that to people. He could rub them up the wrong way.
I think he'd break them, wouldn't he?
Yeah. The thing is, those of us who worked with Andy just realised that he wasn't being nasty. That was the way he did things, and you kind of understood better what he was like. And okay, he's going to go about things that way.
Yeah.
All right, we'll work around him. And it's up to the coach then. The coach then has to make a decision as to whether or not he wants that way of doing things in his team. But for us at the time, he was
brilliant, yeah.
Oh, yeah, he was a force that we needed in there.
Yeah, there was a lot of energy with him and Jeff, wasn't there? And a lot of our success, obviously, you know, Ian and Mark's goals quite rightly grabbed the headlines, really. Mm. But a lot of what was being driven from midfield, from them too. And John on the left was a real threat. And Eddie on the right on his day was a threat as well. So, you know, for those front six, they were all very good players in their own right. And
absolutely. I mean, you touched on something, the energy.
Mm.
We had so much energy. And I think that was another thing that Steve decided in recruitment. He wanted speed and he wanted athleticism. He wanted the energy to be there. And he wanted to be, because he couldn't force the energy into a player. It had to come naturally. And he looked for players that could provide that, because he liked the idea of steamrolling opponents.
Yeah.
Yeah. If they're all flattened by the end of the game, perfect. Move on.
Yes. I mean, the ZDS finals, the, you know, with Youngie doing what he did to Martin Keown. You know, that's, it was very much, that was, I think, Steve liked that. You know, if we could physically just be stronger than the opposition, you know, you're going to win more games than you lose.
You know, Eric and Martin were teammates.
Okay.
Yes. All three of us were at Brighton together.
Of course, yeah.
Martin Keown came on loan as a 19-year-old from Arsenal to Brighton. Eric and I were the two centre-halves. And we stuck him out of full-back.
Well, he's got to learn his place.
I know. And Martin, as you know, is an interesting character.
Mm-hmm. Very intense.
I can understand the Eric situation.
Where is Eric now? Sorry, I'm piping up.
Oh,
Eric
lives on a small remote island in the South Pacific. I'm kidding. Eric was always very much on the private end of the spectrum. He appears from time to time, but he likes to keep himself to himself. And the answer is, I don't know where he is.
I don't know. Wasn't he an accountant or something?
He always was. Before he started as a professional footballer, he was a chartered accountant.
Yeah.
He played for Slough Town or someone like that. And he joined and went to Brighton. Yeah. With his brown headband.
Yes. The ninja.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm just going to get on to some questions that have been set in. Because basically, this usually, Down Memory Lane, is an event at Selhurst. That's run with the Heads Up campaign. So it's Heads Together and the FA. And it's a free event that anyone in the local area can come along to and listen to Harry Byfield, Ian King, chatting to ex-players. So because they couldn't have a Q&A this time, we basically sent an email out to them asking people to send in some questions. So we'll just gradually work through them. Some of them you've probably covered already. You mentioned Right and Bright. Dan from Crawley says, how good was the Right Bright partnership and did they work at their partnership every day in training?
They were okay. They weren't bad. And if you said anything more than that, you'd only give them a bigger head than they've already got. They were awesome. They were built to score goals and everyone else in the team had a duty to provide them with the opportunity to do so. And as Palace fans realised, they didn't let us down too often. Yeah.
No, I think Brighty was a very intelligent footballer, Brighty soon learned that any balls going up to Brighty, he knew where Brighty would lay things off. Brighty was your natural goal scorer. You know, in training, I don't think there's anybody I've trained with who naturally could just score by just passing the ball into the net all the time. He didn't have to hit it hard. It was just always that bit out of reach. He was just such a natural finisher.
And he did like to hammer it. If he could hammer it, he would.
Yeah.
And it was, I mean, I tell you what, the only player I worked with as a player that had a similar finishing ability was Clive Allen.
Yeah.
I mean, for those of you who know Clive, then you, as a former Palace player, scored 50-odd goals for Tottenham in one season. I mean, it's an outrageous amount. And it was always Ian and the ball in the same direction was a goalkeeper's nightmare.
Yeah.
I don't know if you'd agree with that, Nigel.
He could finish. He could finish. Yeah. But Brighty could finish as well.
That's just it. They were they sat together so neatly that what one gave you, the other one didn't. But what the other one gave you, the other one didn't. So they came at you. It was a bit like Rush and Dalglish. They both complemented each other in their styles of play and made them just the perfect storm for a defender.
And everything was great if both of them scored. But if one of them scored and one of them didn't, the other one would sulk briefly.
And by the way, John Sulaco, if John did not deliver the ball first time, Ian would run over and melt his ear with a rather harsh and brutal explanation of what they should do next time they got the ball. So there you go. Dan and Crawley, hope that helps.
Right, moving on from Dan to Jill in Sutton. This one's for Nigel. What did it feel like to be the first goalkeeper to be signing for £1 million?
A little bit surreal. Not my valuation was how I dealt with it. There's no way I, you know, at that time, I would have said any player was worth that amount of money. So to become the first £1 million goalkeeper, there was, everyone was saying there must be a lot of pressure with it, you know, the papers, anyone who sort of interviewed me. And it was, I didn't really feel the pressure of that. You know, for me, I'm just going to go and do what I've been doing and do it to as well as I can every time I play. And that's all I've ever done. That's as much pressure as I put on myself, is to make sure that I'm ready and try my best in every game. Other people's valuations, I sort of let them talk about it. I just sort of said that's Crystal Palace's valuation, not mine, and left it at that.
Did Steve say anything to you when you arrived about the price?
Not really. I remember we went to Chalfont St. Peter, Amanda, myself, and Brendan Batson.
All right.
PFA did my deal, because literally I got the call that I was going, and I didn't have an agent, I didn't have anything, and Jeff Twentyman, who was one of the senior
Bristol
players,
Rovers, yeah.
Bristol Rovers, he said, well, look, just ring the PFA and they'll help. So Brendan Batson came and did my deal. And we went to Chalfont St. Peter to the chairman's house, met Steve for the first time. And Steve was great. He was chatting things through.
Did it spook you with Steve? Because how could someone that short have such a deep voice?
Yeah, very first thing that I thought as soon as he spoke was, wow, that's a deep voice. Absolutely.
Oh, no, that comes from somewhere deep down in the boots.
Yeah, it wasn't Steve that was the problem, because they sort of basically put their offer to us, and Brendan went, well, okay, well, Nigel and Amanda and myself, we just need a quick 5 minutes to discuss it. And they went out the room, and Amanda started writing down, you know, right, okay, gas, electric, you know, we start doing little things like this.
Oh no, you stood on budget.
Yeah, and it's how we were living in Bristol. It was bizarre, you know, we had no money. We literally had no money, but it was... I wouldn't have changed that for the world, but it was how we were. We were brought up, you know, you didn't have anything that you couldn't afford. So with what Palace were offering, we were going through what we thought the cost in London would be. And we were, you know, we're adding all this up, and Brendan was sort of saying, yeah, you know, it's, but I think you're going to be okay and everything. And we were like, yeah, we just want to make sure. And then Ron Nodes just burst into the room and goes, come on, what's going on? You're taking so long. And Amanda had a cup of tea in her hand, and you could hear the cup was shaking on the sword. But Brendan stepped up and just said, Ron, look, you're not helping. Go out the room. Just give us a few more minutes. And then, you know, we went through everything and suddenly realised.
He was quite a calm character, Brendan.
Yeah, he was he was great. He was just perfect for what we needed at that time. You know, it wasn't, for me, it wasn't about the... I think if I'd have had an agent at that time, you know, somebody else would have exploited the situation more and developed sort of my off-field stuff a lot more. But it wasn't what we wanted. We just
there wasn't a lot there back in 1989 where you could do a lot of off-field development. You were either a big enough star already, and it came with you, or you weren't going to have any, and it was up to you to grow it and then maybe develop it in the future. So it's different times.
They were, but that's something all the way through my career I sort of went against, really. I never got involved with that side of it, with sort of self-promotion or anything like that. For me, there was enough time spent training, playing games, and the rest of the time I wanted to be at home.
It is what it is. I mean, it's an individual choice. And there's no judgment on that. Go on, next question, Chris.
Next question, Steve from Purley. I understand Steve Coppell arranged something special from your families for the players in the Wembley dressing rooms. What was that?
Gosh.
Yeah. Ooh. We had telegrams in the. There were a few telegrams and things that we had.
Which
I remember.
Telegrams, yeah. Telegrams. How about that? How old are we? Telegrams.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because I think Brighty had it in his book. I'm sure he said that he had a telegram from an old teacher or someone back at home.
That was emotional.
Obviously, it wasn't emotional for you too.
I had telegrams from my parents, I think from Amanda. Amanda and her parents or something like that. So whether Steve had organised that, to this day, I don't know.
No, I'll be honest with you. It was always a thing to get a telegram. You know, it was like an upgrade from a letter. It was very, very important if you had a telegram, you know. So yeah, that may have been it. Otherwise, I can't remember what it was.
I can't remember anything else. No.
We're old, we forget.
Pards actually did a lot for the cup run in 2016 of the same thing. So he had in the dressing room on that day, obviously now we've moved on from telegram to actually painting the walls with images of their family and quotes from them. And messages. But he also did fish and chips on the Friday before every FA Cup game because you guys did it in 1990. And then obviously in the semi-final, he did the flick-on header routine. Exactly the same as the Pardew one.
The bus stop?
Whatever one he scored in 90 against Liverpool, we did it against Watford in the semi-final and Balassi.
No, we used to have a free kick. If we had a free kick in the centre circle, Andy Thorne would take it because he had a great delivery. And I dubbed it the bus stop because we all lined up. And I'm thinking, first time we ever did it. And I turned around the cop and said, is there a bus coming? Why are we stood all like this? And then it would just split. And then we'd, I think myself, I would be in there. We'd be fighting for a flick on. And then we had, I think Andy and Pards would be sat with what we called an umbrella around the arc of the 18-yard area. So if it came out, we'd be on it first. And then Wrighty and whoever would be splintering off and looking for pieces. So, yeah, we were very, very organised with set plays because we realised that, you know what, we may not be the Real Madrid of South London that we thought we were. But we could use set plays to our advantage, and we did. We upset a lot of teams with those.
I'm sure they still call it the bus stop.
So they should.
I've definitely heard them say, because I watch with the analysts, and they were every now and then they say, we're doing the bus stop now, aren't we?
Yeah, there you go.
There you go. You're immortalised, Gary.
how does that not sound a compliment?
Right, Paul from Sig Cup says, how surprised were the players to see all the red and blue balloons and the atmosphere that the fans created on that day at Wembley?
I think Gary spoke earlier about the Cup semi-final and the final and it being on the telly. But the emotion, because we remember it, because of the emotion, the sound we remember, but visually we remember all those balloons, back, you know, coming onto the pitch and at the start of the game. And It was special, I think. You know, to see that was, and it's your crowd doing it. You know what I mean? It sort of gave me a lift, and it's a memory that I've got really vividly because of the balloons and everything. I think it was a great idea.
I wasn't so surprised at Wembley, but at Villa Park for the semi. I mean, that was just the most amazing scene. All those red and blue balloons. That was Palace fans saying, we're here. This is us. And they just changed the dynamic of how you would go about a semi-final and a final. And I think they were letting people know that they were going to be around.
Mm. I've got it here, actually. Can you see this?
Yeah.
Yes.
There's their manager, Alex Ferguson, describing this as the biggest day of his life. And Steve Coppell, at 34, the youngest ever manager of an FA Cup final team. And what a moment it is for these Palace lads and their fans. The first time the club has been in the FA Cup final. And they're bound to get an appropriate reception. Crystal Palace, very much the underdogs. But as we've been saying since we came on the air, this is all on the day, and who knows what to expect. One or two United players a bit late out there, but now they're into the fresh air of Wembley. And just listen to this. Crystal Palace, who's played in all the divisions of the Football League. This is their finest hour, really, in the public eye. Only 14,000 of their supporters actually got tickets. But both of these clubs have quite a following in other countries as well. And a nice moment as Steve Coppell, a former Manchester United Cup finalist on three occasions, talks to his opposite number. They're great friends away from the tension of this occasion, the two managers. And as they stride across this quite perfect surface, the team's already entering into the mood of the day. And Geoff Thomas, who actually is a Manchester boy by birth, captain of Crystal Palace, will now present his players to the Duke. Nigel Martin, the goalkeeper, was the first one in, and Andy Thorne, who played here 2 years ago, knows about the ceremonials here. David Madden got the second substitute's position, by the way. Alan Pardew, the light-haired player, got the winner in the semi-final. Phil Barber next to him is a wide player. And then we have Mark Bright and Ian Wright, who in the end was a substitute. Andy Gray, we'll watch for him on the free kicks and corners. Richard Shaw, the left-back with the dreadlocks. John Sulaco from Nigeria. And Johnny Pemberton. And David Madden next to Steve Coppell.
What's it like watching that back?
Weird. How short was Schultz? Man. Yeah, that's quite strange. But walking out of the tunnel, we had the privilege of seeing our fans at the far end. So therefore, the whole red and blue balloon thing just hit you straight in the face. Because the United guys were behind us.
Yes.
Therefore, you weren't able to see what was going on, but we had that opportunity to see our fans really just make a statement once again.
It was brilliant to see. It sort of makes you doubly desperate to do well, doesn't it, on the day, you know, all your guys are there.
Yeah.
So you so want to do well.
It is. It's, you know, you see the marching band and everything else. Because, I mean, Nigel, you're younger than I am, but growing up, the FA Cup final was one of the very few games would be shown live on television.
Yeah, yeah.
And so outside of an England international or a World Cup, the FA Cup was the one thing that you would be able to see live. And therefore, it crystallises in every football fan, every young fan, everyone together. Today, it's maybe not as, I suppose, not the same, because there is so much more. Well, not right now. But you know, historically, there's been so much to be able to see from around the world, and the number of games you can watch in the Premier League or the Football League. So, you know, for me, that was just an amazing thing. You're walking past this marching band. You're walking out in front of these crowds. I mean, I played at Wembley before for Tottenham. And so it wasn't quite the unique occasion, but it doesn't diminish what you feel. And Nigel, you've walked out there as an international. It gets you every time.
There was something special about the old Wembley Stadium as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
I'm not that much younger than you, Gary. And
take it, run with it.
Yeah, but Cup Final Day was always, it was so magical. It was a whole day event.
Yeah.
You know, on the telly, and it was on both sides. When BBC One and ITV both had it. And there were all sorts of events happening all morning. So as kids, we'd be over at the park playing football. We could walk to the local shop, to get our sort of sweets and crisps and drink to watch the game. And then after the game, it was straight back over the park to play football with your mates again and sort of reenact what you just watched. But it was such an exciting day. And you didn't necessarily need to support the team that was in the final. It was just it was always a magical day. So having seen all those and grown up watching all those games, to suddenly be there at Wembley and to see, you know, the dressing rooms were massive and, you know, everything is just completely different from any other football stadium you've been in, was really amazing. And it was great. It was great. You know, the only thing that was missing was the silverware at the end, really.
That's, you know, yeah. And there's, you know, however many times you replay it, it never changes. But what I think was great is because now you would have that experience, but now and again, the game itself would be a bit of a, yeah, not that great. But we didn't hand one of those over. We at that time, we were, like I said, it was the team that we didn't have reverse in the gearbox. We were always going to take it on the front foot and attack. So we, along with our opponents, delivered a quite spectacular game for all that's worth.
Yeah. Today.
Started off with you though, Gary. And Gordon from East Grinstead says, what did it mean to be the opening Palace goal scorer in the afternoon in an FA Cup final?
Part of a young football fan's dream come true to score in an FA Cup final. To be in an FA Cup final was part of a dream. To score a goal is another part. To score a winning goal, well, that would have been it. Scoring a goal and then knowing that that probably won't be the winner. Let's see how this goes. It was, I can't deny it, a most amazing moment. And a moment that all of the stuff that you suffered through has been worth it if it means I got that moment. And, you know, just you feel blessed to have had that opportunity. But, you know, me, it's, I've got on the end of something we constructed. We touched on this earlier on, a free kick. And it was designed intentionally to be a difficult free kick to defend against. And Nigel will tell you, so if you've got defenders coming back towards his own goal, then the chances of a problem become that much greater. So Phil Barber now is going to stick in an in-swinger. Now that then immediately drags players on top of Jim Leighton, the Manchester United goalkeeper. And so it's now a case of just how much pain can we inflict? We were set up to score directly from the free kick. And we were set up to score from the second ball, anything that scraps that came off of that free kick. And that's, you know, that was set. Everybody, as soon as this free kick comes in that position, we knew what we've got. And so you can see us there, the movements there, Andy, Mark and myself. And Jim Leighton gets caught in one of those horrible positions, as Nigel will understand, that he can do nothing about. Thank you for sharing that. Reminded me just how dark my hair used to be. And look at that. That, I mean, they could not have believed they'd be seeing their team score a goal in a cup final. But there it is.
Yeah, that was it. You know, the idea, you know, you've given your own supporters something. But, you know, I can remember Andy running over the ball. You know, his defenders, you start moving towards the goalkeeper at that point. He runs over it, so they're already deeper than they would have been. Yeah. And then Phil's delivery is into the right area to draw Jim Leighton out. It is a great delivery, and it's a horrible ball for...
I mean, Nigel, you've got professional respect for someone like Jim Leighton.
Yeah,
and absolutely. And like I said, it was designed to cause as much problem as it possibly could. And
yeah.
Obviously succeeded.
Yeah, no, it was well worked, and oh, don't like looking at this one too much.
Yeah, fast forward, please.
to be honest, Brian Robson's got a free header at the far post.
Yeah,
it's a comfortable save for me.
Deflection, doesn't it?
Until John Pemberton goes and tries to kick it in front of me, and I think it comes off his shin. So this is coming straight at me, no problem. Pembo off his shin into the corner.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
he's trying to defend it in the right way. Everyone sort of says, oh, did you have a go at him for it? No, he's trying to stop it. That's his first job, is to try and stop it. You know, mine is to try and save the original shot.
That one, it's, if I'm not mistaken, it takes another nick. And Mark Hughes, to his credit, knows that position is always a great place to go if you're a striker. See him number 10 there? I'm drawn towards Brian McClair. He just sits in there.
We think Thorny's clearing it anyway, don't we?
Yeah.
Thorny's kicking it and just gets charged down. And that's why people are free, because at that time, you know, we're looking to push out.
In this one, Pallister gets his blood twisted.
Yeah.
And the rest, as they say, is history. See, the calmness of Ian there, having just come on and then not lose his cool and finish precisely. Remember right. Stan Turnant, Nige?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Right, Stan used to preach to Ian all the time, go cold in the box, go cold in the box, go cold in the box. And this is what he meant. Don't be rushing your thoughts. Be calm. Know exactly how you're going to do it and where it's going to go. And he took that advice on and became the striker we all know he was. Look, he's cut inside to make the target bigger. He knows exactly what he wants to do.
He was so good at that side foot finish. You know, he was so precise on that. It was so difficult to stop.
Further forward now that Shaw is in an orthodox left-back position here. That's Sulaco is playing wide on the left in Barber's old position.
See, you've turned their defence. And that's the problem.
And that's my
see that bit? Yeah. That right foot that we introduced John Sulaco to paid off.
And that,
I mean, it's a great goal.
That cross is a horrible cross for Jim as well.
Yeah.
You know, because he's cut back. Everyone's moved out. The cross is another in-swinger as well, but it's deep. You know, he wanted it more floaty, a bit slower. It's the pace on the cross.
Yeah.
And it's so difficult for him.
Look, he's pulled off Steve Bruce there. He just knows as soon as John Sulaco cuts back, that cross is coming in, even though it's on the right foot. Boom.
Yeah.
Because that got worked on. And he knows. And that's just raw pace that's got him in there behind Bruce.
Well, slow this bit down. This is where Andy Gray just goes flying over the boards in a different direction to everyone else. And then before you know it, they're calling everyone back. But there's no video of what he did. I presume he tried to get in amongst the fans. That's horrible.
Yeah.
It is, because you're thinking, could I have played him offside? But that's a big gamble, because we conceded a goal in the semi-final against Liverpool trying to play offside, or I did, and I wasn't really going to allow history to repeat itself. But I get there a fraction of a second.
I know, and the same for me, because I'm drawn towards it, and I'm trying to cut down the distance between me and Mark. So literally, I'm on top of him, so he can't sort of score. And he just gets that just before I get there, and it goes just past my foot, and I think it goes in. You know, it's about a foot inside the post. So sometimes you got to give credit where it's due to the striker.
Yeah, I mean, you're looking there at goals scored by two of the best strikers we've seen during that era, without a doubt, Mark and Ian.
And nobody lost.
Is this a strange moment where it's so odd to think that there weren't penalties and that you play all this extra time and then you just go up to where you would be collecting medals and you're just shaking everyone's hand.
Yeah. For me,
I suppose so, yeah.
It had to be finished on the day. It was an empty feeling. We played this final, all the build-up and everything we've had, and there's nothing at the end of it. It felt quite bizarre, really.
Live to fight another day. Get a chance to come back and do it all again.
Mm. But Eamon Smith says, do you think that if the final was decided on penalties, you would have had a chance of winning? So maybe one for you, Nigel.
We'd have had a chance.
Yeah.
For sure. You don't know. There's no way of knowing. Personally, I was left with a very empty feeling on the day that it needed to have been finished then. You know, whichever way that would have gone for us, I think I would have accepted. I think even if we'd have lost a penalty shootout, I wouldn't have been clamouring for a replay. Oh, it should have been a replay or anything like that.
Sorry, Nigel, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it just felt like it was built to that day, and that was the the peak of the summit, and it should have just been sorted there, because I think we were already coming down the other side for the replay. It was a strange thing.
I think if we, looking back and sort of being sort of slightly paternal, if we'd have gone to penalties on the back of the first game, having so many young players, two teenagers, a couple of early 20-somethings, and the burden had fallen to them and they'd have missed a penalty, what mentally that destruction that could have done to such a young player, and then maybe not have the career they went on to have. So yes and no, as to your point, and just to me thinking, you know what, that would be cruel. That would be cruel to destroy a young player mentally at that point, because it takes an awful lot to get over a penalty miss on a stage that big. Because it's not just us in England. The whole world sits down and watches the FA Cup final. Nigel, you've probably met people. Do you know, I was in New Zealand when I saw da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And you're like, wow. It never fails to strike a chord with me when you bump into people around the world and they tell you where they were at that moment.
Yeah. Although on the flip side, it could have made them heroes.
I totally get it. It's a flip of a coin. It's going to be one or the other.
Yeah.
And then there was the replay. David Gerling says, why was the cup final replay so disappointing compared to the final itself?
And then because we lost.
Yeah, well, Peter Jepp just said, why did we do?
I guess it was after the Lord Mayor's show a little bit. You know, it's the end of a long season. The lads have just given 120 minutes off
again.
And, you know, we have a night afterwards, which was a bit strange. And then, you know, so it's not ideal preparation for a game 3 days later either. And I think, you know, at the end of a long season, at the end of the game, I think both teams were flat, to be honest. I don't think United had any more energy than we did. It was just...
No, I think maybe you're right. Maybe we'd given everything we had. And that becomes a test of character, which I don't think we would ever fail. Just now, there are times now and again, like at the end of the first game, I did everything I could to get in front of Mark Hughes and block the shot.
Yeah.
And it's a case that I got there as soon as I could without being sarcastic.
Yeah, no.
You know, and Wrighty, if he's watching this, will be screaming and shouting and throwing things at me. So behave.
I know, he's probably saying I should have stayed on the line, but at that time, that split second that ball gets played, that's when I have to make my
decision. No.
And, you know, in that situation, probably 8 times out of 10, the ball's going to come off me at somewhere. It's going to hit me because I'm spreading myself close to him. You know, it's just, that's, you know, he's, you know, that's what a great striker he was, because he probably had a foot to kick the ball in, and under pressure, he's managed to put it down that channel and put it inside the post. And
doesn't mean I like him. Just I respect him for his goal-scoring ability.
Absolutely. No, the second game was disappointing all the way through.
And don't, please, if there is a question about why this yellow and black stripes, I think it's something to do with Jeff's school team.
I think I'll leave the yellow and black. Yeah, it's something to do with the school team, isn't it?
Yeah, so it is what it is. Any more questions?
Two more, which are just general ones, so they're not about specifically the 1990 game. Anne Collins, which game that you played in do you regard as most memorable?
May I say, from my Palace time, I am honoured to have had three. I work at the last one and go backwards. The Cup final, the first game, the semi-final against Liverpool, and then the playoff, the final playoff game the season before against Blackburn Rovers at Selhurst Park.
That was amazing. Pitch invasion.
That was the most spectacular game. Again, three games, all with extra time.
Yeah.
The Blackburn game, we weren't given a hope of coming back, but they didn't.
Big deficit.
Yeah, and we just went, right, okay, let's do it. We're at home. We expect to win. And we did.
Well, for me and my Palace days, obviously, the semi-final, the final, they're the top ones. But also getting promotion back into the Premier League was something that was really good with a completely different Palace team, you know, quite a few years later. But that was nice to do, because as good as we were and to win the ZDS and to finish third, really from there, the sort of Premier League years after that, I think we were like 12th, then relegated, then to get promoted, and then to get relegated again. It was a very up and down sort of time, but you know, it was special to get back up as champions as well, because we ran away with it that year. But I think we were unlucky on relegation. I think
Alan Smith was manager then, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He did a really good job, because obviously we got relegated, and Steve just said, "Well, that's it. You know, I'm done."
You destroyed what was then the Championship. You absolutely ate it. I mean, who was in that team? I mean, I think we can guess who was in goal. So Gareth, was Chris Coleman there then?
Chris Coleman, yeah.
And Gareth Southgate. I mean, by the way, two of the best centre halves to wear the blue and red stripes.
Yeah, we had Darren Patterson played centre half as well. Crumbs, I'm looking back. Chris Armstrong, obviously.
Who was in the back? Was Shorey there, Richard?
Yeah, Richard was there. I'm thinking.
Had Stan gone? Stan Collymore gone by then?
I think Stan must have been gone. You're putting me on the spot. Yeah, I mean, yes.
Right, no problem. No, I won't do that. So no, there was. Anyway, look. You flew the Championship, so whoever was in the team weren't bad.
No. We did storm it, and you know, the following year to get relegated again was really disappointing. So I think we went down fourth bottom one year when they were making changes to how many teams were in the Premier League, and the year after I think we had some sort of record for a team to get relegated. So you know, both times we were probably unfortunate. In the other years we would have probably stayed up, but you know, that was they were the downsides, because you know, the cup final and the run to finish third and winning the ZTS were the good times. After that it was just very much up and down, and it wasn't really the stability that you need at a club. There was a lot of change in player and management, really. So it was a funny time, and lots of our top players sort of left at that time, and it was hard.
Palace fans understand that.
Yeah.
Go on. You had another question.
Last one, yeah, completely. John Davison, who is the most unpredictable attacker you faced whilst at Palace?
Unpredictable? They could all be unpredictable. You know, if you took one for granted that you thought was rubbish, and I'm not going to give any names, they'd score because you weren't doing your job properly. I think you had to pay them the level of respect and do the best every single time. I mean, there were guys that would just be lethal. Ian Rush was all probably continually on the top of the don't like you list for me. Mark Hughes, who we have discussed ad nauseum. But there were guys who would just, you know, have a knack of just drifting off. They'd kind of like lull you into a false sense of security, and then pop, they'd go away. They'd just let you just allow you to just get your concentration to drift away, and then they just move. You know, and those guys are so dangerous. The guys that are in your face and busy and giving you rubbish and talking in your ear, they're always there. You know where they are. It's the guys that disappear off the radar, go stealth on you. They're the ones. They're the ones you have to know how to defend properly against. So it's about touch tight. It's about all the little techniques that you learn and you use to be able to keep rascals like them at bay.
Yeah, there's plenty. It was almost every team you came against had at least two or three that were the real goal threats. And so you were always conscious of those. From my point of view, everything I do is pretty much reactive. Obviously, reading game situation, which is something you get better at as you get older. Yeah. is obviously you're predetermining a certain part of it, but a lot of it is you're just reacting to a pass, a shot, or whatever. So you're always reacting to situations. So unpredictability is just something that you have to put up with. But I mean, there are plenty of strikers who got lots of goals against me. Shearer was one. Robbie Fowler was one. Ian Rush was another. And you do get those that score, but from my point of view, it's all to do with the situation that's been created. There's probably, you know, in any given situation, you can probably put odds, you know, stack odds where they're 60% in their favour or 60% in my favour, and they're the ones that you've got to do better with. It's the ones that are sort of 80-90% in their favour are, you know, you don't worry so much about, because there's nothing you can do about those. It's the ones that you can have some influence on that you actually try and do something with. But yeah, there's nobody that you're sort of scared of, because any given day you go into the game thinking that it's going to be your day anyway. You think it's going to be, you know, I always think, right, you know, we start with a clean sheet, I want to finish with one, and that's how I approached every sort of game.
Perfect. That's it. I'm all out of questions from our memory lane attendees. Thanks so much for spending nearly an hour and a half.
Good luck editing this.
Yeah.
Got to get it up by tomorrow. Just have to put it up.
It'll take that long to upload.
Yeah, I know. That is so annoying. My home Wi-Fi. Trying to do anything. No, thanks, guys. I really appreciate the amount of time.
You're welcome.
Steve Coppell tomorrow morning, actually, so...
I will send him my regards. Send him my regards, would you please?
Well, I do.
Enjoy the rest of whatever happens for the next few months.
Yeah, stay well, people.